Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Patty.
I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you for entertaining while I was using the ladies' room. I thought 10 minutes was 10 minutes. I'm really grateful to be here. I've had one of those days that feels like a week, and I don't know about the rest of you, but when I get going in the morning and I'm just kind of like zoom, 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 and all revved up and going, there's nothing more serene for me than to come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't seem to me to matter what's going on out there or how revved up I am or how busy I am. When I come here and I hear the words, rarely have we seen a person fail, read, and I come into the room with you, I know I'm going to be okay for an hour and a half. And so I was really grateful to be here, to arrive here tonight, and thank you for sharing with us. I'm always a little concerned when a speaker at an AA meeting starts out by saying, I was born, especially if they're old, because then it's like, hey, God, you're going to have to listen for a really long time. But I want to start out tonight by saying I was born February 3rd, 1949, and that's not important to any of you. It's really important to me because, you see, up until that day, everything in my life was fine. Up until that day, I had enough of everything. Everything was the right kind, and everything, I had no complaints. And it seems to me from the day I was born till just recently in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has never been enough, and it's never been the right kind. I always needed more. I always needed different. I always needed something else. And as alcoholics, I think we're good getters. I would get stuff. But whatever it was I would get, it wasn't the right stuff. It wasn't the right job. It wasn't the right relationship. It wasn't the right place to live. It was never right. I always needed different. I always needed more. And I didn't know that that was a spiritual malady. I didn't know that I suffered from a spiritual malady, that no matter what happened on the outside, it wasn't going to be enough and it wasn't going to be the right kind. I didn't have any idea about that. What happened to me is when I was 13 years old, I had my first drink of alcohol. And as far as I can remember, I don't remember ever thinking about alcohol. I don't remember ever making any pledges that I would never drink. I don't remember ever sitting around plotting for my first drink, waiting to have my first drink. I don't remember thinking about alcohol one way or another. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camping on the beach just south of Oceanside. And I remember getting into the tent that first night, and I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I think it was the grace of God, but I can never be sure. But I remember pulling it out of the pillowcase, and I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with. It was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about any of you, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard you talk about your first drink. And you talked about taking the drink, and you felt the liquid in your mouth, and you somehow felt it as it went down your throat, and you traced it as it went to your stomach, and it hit your stomach, and it exploded, and went to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples fell off, and you grew a few inches, and you lost weight, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything, in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. And I don't know how I knew it, but I had an intuitive thought that the body was somehow made up of energy. And I somehow figured out at 13 years old that if I could gather my energy, that I would somehow be all right. So there I sat, paralyzed, gathering my energy. And I suppose it was my first formal meditation because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, when it seemed to be all centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, I've learned that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy that I was in the Marines, I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety, and if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I always have to tell you that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage somehow to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the side of the tent, the top of the tent, I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous, fabulous, magnificent spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a problem with it. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. And I don't know how I knew that. I don't know how I knew that that stuff had alcohol in it. How do we... I mean, it's something I think that's intuitively born into the alcoholic. My next-door neighbors do not know that you can get a high drinking Aqua Velva. But I knew it. And I came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And I don't think this is unusual. I don't think I'm living any different than anybody else. I don't know that what I'm doing, you are doing, but they're not doing. And, you know, when I think about it in retrospect, and everything I know is in retrospect. I mean, we don't know we're putting a story together when we're putting it together. If I would have known when I was out there that what I was doing was going to be important, if I would have known when I was out there that I was going to be expected to report to you what I was doing out there, I would not have done some of the things that I did. If I would have known I was going to have to report it, I would have paid a lot more attention to my life. But I didn't know I was going to have to report it, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. So a lot of it, it's all in retrospect. And a lot of it actually has been reported to me by other people. And I just have to sort of believe they told me the truth. I mean, I love blackouts. I don't understand people in AA who share, and they say, you know, and I was drinking last night, and I realized I missed 7 minutes of the evening, and it scared me to death, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love blackouts. I wish I could have a blackout sober. I don't think there's anything more exciting than leaving work on September 12th, going back to work on September 20th, and discovering you've been there the whole week. But when you're a blackout drinker, you have to sort of get your story from other people. And you have to just believe they're not lying to you. I have a job that I had to get a fingerprint clearance for. I fingerprint really well. I've done it a lot. When they were fingerprinting me, I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I kind of calmly said to the woman doing the printing, I said, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, geez, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So when my report came back, I actually know a lot more about my story after reading that report than I did before I was fingerprinted. So, you know, the pieces sort of fill in as you go. But this is, you know, this is my story, and this is how I remember it. I don't know I'm living any different than anybody else. I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, an alley drinker, an office drinker, a dumpster drinker, a car drinker. I mean, I didn't specialize. I drank, but I love bars. I love really sleazy bars. What kind with the sawdust on the floor? And the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to duck around to see yourself in there. And the upholstery around the bar is ripped, or people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their bar stools. And they're full of smoke, and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still when I think of it. I love that smell. Sometimes when I'm at work and I'm in a really cranky mood, I'll drive over to one of those places and just open the door and take a big hit off of it just to perk me up for the rest of the day. But I'm fascinated about the quality of people who drank in those places. I mean, there were CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents, admirals in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. And I never told a lie in a sleazy bar, so I mean, I guess they are. But we weren't having conversation. We weren't sitting around there looking at one another saying, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me that I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State, and I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. And the only reason I share that is it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I stayed in school and took classes for a master's degree because I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. So I kept going to school, and I took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego, and I've been offered a job in Chico, California. And I loaded up my car, everything I owned. I had two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which is about 80 miles north of San Diego. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. So I pulled off the freeway. I pulled into the parking lot of the sleaziest bar in town. I have a sense I can find them. I don't even have to look for them. Pulled into the parking lot, walked in this place. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful smell, and Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down and ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got, 80 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, honesty, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And by the time I got here, it had taken it all. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. It controlled where I would live and where I would work. 80 miles north, and I had a good job that I was headed for. And I ended up 80 miles north of where I started from, unemployed, sitting in a bar ordering one more drink. Just give me one more drink. Just give me one more drink. I'm going to figure it out. Just give me one more drink. I didn't know I had a spiritual malady that I couldn't fill with anything. I didn't know that alcohol wasn't going to fill it, but I was trying as hard as I could. Just give me one more drink. And I ended up getting a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about is I was in the newspaper business, and we were a community paper, and so we often gave awards. And I know tonight, because God gave me a gift, we often won awards. But I didn't tell you part of the times that I would come out of a blackout behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down. And then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 26 years old. That was young when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's pretty old to be getting here now, but it was young then. And I told you I was too young to be an alcoholic. I was 26 years old. I graduated college with a 3.8 grade point average. I'd taken classes for a master's degree. I'd risen to the top of my profession. I was too successful. I was too successful, I was too smart, and I was too young to be an alcoholic. And like you, what they said to me was keep coming back. I came here on a court card, and I'd wave my court card in their face, I'd flip them off, and I'd tell them I didn't have an effing choice. I had to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd sit back down. And I arrived here I have a driving problem. I mean, I'll admit that freely. I'm driving down the street, and the light comes on behind me. Now, I know what that light means. You know, there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that think that light means put the pedal to the metal and take off like a bat out of hell. I know what it means. It means pull over. So I pull over. The officer comes up to the door. The first thing I do is slam the car door open and try and knock off his private parts. Now, men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door is flying open, he jumps back. And it's good when he jumps back because now I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and I go for him. And it's a pretty fair fight for a couple minutes, but I never remember that he's got a friend back at the car. And the friend's got a radio, and the friend calls some more friends. And pretty soon it's six of them, one of me. Well, I know it's not fair anymore. And I say, uncle. And they take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam the door open. He jumps back. I get him in focus. I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me. I think I can take him. One of him, one of me. It looks like a fair fight. One of him, one of me. I think I'll try, and I go for him. I don't remember the friend or the radio. I don't remember the friend's friends. Pretty soon it's six of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. I say, uncle, and they take me away. I don't do that once or twice. I do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. 12 times, I never remember the friend in the radio and the friend's friends. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over and over. And I think the results are going to be different. This time, I'm going to take him. This time, it's going to be a fair fight. This time, I'm going to win. And do you know, when you do that, they don't care that they win the fight. Drunk driving assault. Drunk driving assault. They put an assault charge on. They don't care that they won. They always tack an assault charge on there. Now, I have a reputation in Orange County as a violent drunk, and I don't know it. when you get out of the car that way, they start thinking you're violent. And I have a reputation in Orange County as a violent drunk, only I don't know I'm violent. And one night I'm at the bar drinking and thinking. I think all the time. I still think all the time. If you're new and they tell you don't think, if you figured out how to do it, let me know. I don't know how not to think. I'm talking to you. I'm already thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking. That I'll tell you what, I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head. Can you imagine if everything you thought came barreling out? I mean, that... Ooh. But I thought all the time drinking, I think all the time sober, and I'm in the bar drinking, thinking. And the bar closes, and I leave, and I'm going home thinking. I'm driving thinking. And I turn left onto my street thinking. And as I turn onto my street, the power steering goes out of my car. Do you ever notice as alcoholics, bad timing? Bad things happen at inappropriate times. Power steering goes out. I slam into a car parked on the left-hand side of the street. Well, of course, I panic. I just turned the wheel just a teensy-weensy to get back to the middle. I slammed into a car on the right. Turn it a little, and I slammed into one on the left, and I slammed into one on the right, and I slammed into one on the left. I finally turned into my driveway, and I was so grateful that I had gotten home safely. I just sat there for a moment, and after my moment of gratitude, I went in the house. I couldn't have been in the house but a minute or two, and the doorbell rings. It's 20 after 2 in the morning. Who is visiting me now? People never leave you alone. Somebody always wants something. Could you give me my beverage of choice there? Thank you. It used to be Jack Daniels. Now it's Arrowhead. Come a long way. But it's still out of the bottle. People, they always want something. They're always bothering you. They never leave you alone. I'm disgusted. I opened the door. It's the Orange County Sheriff. And I looked him right in the eye. I said, what do you want? Do you know what time it is? He wanted me to come out on the front yard. Well, I started telling him about my car. Apparently, it wasn't mechanical. He didn't care about my car. He points down the street at all these cars that are smashed out. And I said, and isn't it grand that I got home safely? He didn't care about that either. He opened the back seat of his car. He wanted me to get in. Now, I'm in the newspaper business. I've done the ride-along. I don't have time for the ride-along tonight. Done it before. I'll do it again. I don't have time tonight. I've got to get up early. I've got a 7 o'clock meeting. He's insisting I get in his car. I think, well, he's not going to leave. He needs some company. I better go with him. I get in the car. In Orange County, our sheriffs have a fence between the front seat and the back seat. I don't know what it's there for. I never could figure it out. But I get in the car, and because I have a reputation as a violent drunk, he shackles my ankles. And he shackles my hands behind my back, and he starts taking me for a ride, and I don't have time. And I start asking him where we're going. He won't talk to me. I ask him some other questions. He won't answer me. Keep talking to him. He won't respond. Now, I don't know about you, but I get irritated when they won't respond. Now we're on the freeway. We're going north. And the devil flew in me. And I don't know if the devil ever flew in you, but the devil flew in me that night, and I just honked up a big one. I just spit right on the back of his head. See, you're a little amused by it. He wasn't amused at all. He sped up, and he started going faster and faster and faster. And when the speedometer hit 100 miles an hour, he slammed on the brake. And I'm shackled, and I'm cuffed, and I can't break the fall, and I went face forward into that metal grate. My glasses broke. I had blood everywhere. It was a mess. But I'll never forget that night they were taking my mugshot. They kept referring to me as Waffle Face because I had the... And I don't know that it's alcoholism. I don't even know that alcohol has any part to play in it. I think it's you and they and them. It's the cops. They're always after me. If they just leave me alone, why don't they go after the criminals? Why are they bothering me? If you would just behave right, if they would just leave me alone, it's you and they and them, it's the cops, it's circumstances and conditions, a lot of things. Never occurs to me it has anything to do with alcohol. And I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of my 12th drunk driving assault charge. And I'm very anal. I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report and I read it. I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And on my, what I pray God was my last drunk driving, I was doing a really good job. I'd have given myself an A+. I was doing a really, I mean, by that time I knew, touch your finger with your nose with your finger, it meant this, it doesn't mean this. I can walk the line, I can stand on one foot, I can do all this stuff. And at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had confessed and he took me away, so... On the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. He didn't think it was funny. I can guarantee you he didn't think it was funny. He cuffed me and took me to Orange County Jail, and I went to court on that drunk driving. I was 26 years old, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different, and he looked at me, and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance, and he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you that I left the courtroom. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems of my life. I worked them all in the first week, and I skyrocketed to recovery. But that's not my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing, what the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a Sunday night, and it was a speaker meeting. And I don't know who talked that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I looked around, and none of you were drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? This made me really nervous. I figured the judge made a horrid mistake. If he'd have sent me to Sears School of Safe Driving, I would have understood. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard in that meeting was that the answers were in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in this book, I couldn't even find the questions. I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book. I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And so on Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. That's the only reason I came back. I don't think it matters why you come back. I think what's important is that you come back. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, my second meeting was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you have nice cars. I have a record as a car thief. I know how to get those. Some of you have nice spouses. We all know how to get those. I couldn't figure out what it was you had, and then I saw him. I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He wore baggy pants and a thin belt. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. I quickly assessed that he was shooting heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I can probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. As I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my recovery where my entire life has fallen apart. I've gone through times sober where I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships, I've lost stuff. And it seemed to me in those times that God brought me this far and then took off to 10 to 1 of you and left me. And I didn't drink and I didn't die and I didn't drink and I didn't die to get far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I have thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. So I don't know good from bad for me. But every area in my life is different than it was the day I walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. You see, all I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. If God had let me have it my way in the last 23 years, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 23 years I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. There's a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. I have a really wild imagination, but beyond my wildest imagination, there's a plan. My job is to not drink, suit up, show up, and live life to the fullest, and let the plan unfold no matter what, no matter how painful I think it is. You see, when I made a choice to recover, my sobriety was a gift. I have no doubt about that. I was given the gift of sobriety on October 4th, 1975. And I've heard people say it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink. I want you to know it's been necessary for me to take a drink. It's been an emergency. It's been so necessary for me to drink. It's been overwhelmingly, incredibly, phenomenally necessary for me to take a drink, but because the steps work, and because you've been willing to share your experience, strength, and hope with me, no matter how necessary it's been, I haven't taken a drink since I walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never planned to stay this long. So my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. And I believe if you're sitting here tonight and you haven't had a drink today, your sobriety is a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. Recovery for me was a choice. I made a choice to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't wait nearly as long as you did. I only waited 8.5 months. 8.5 months of not drinking, I made a choice to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to tell you it was out of virtue, but it was not. I've been in pain in recovery. I've been in real, severe emotional pain in recovery. But I want you to know that I have never experienced a pain greater than the pain of not drinking and not recovering. There has not been any pain greater for me than the pain of not drinking and not recovering. And for me, at 8.5 months sober, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I had a choice. Either choose to recover or leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the grace of God, that morning, I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took the first step. And the first step for me was simple. I'm powerless over alcohol. Whenever I drink alcohol, I'm damned to live the same way day after day after day after day. When I drink alcohol, I have no choices. When I drink alcohol, alcohol controls my life. My life's unmanageable because alcohol manages my life. Alcohol determines where I'll live, where I'll work, the people I'll run with, the people I'll eventually run from. And I have no choices. My only choice is to go to a bar and order one more drink. My only choice is to sit on a bar stool and dream dreams and plan plans. And someday I'll. And I order another drink, and I never get off the bar stool. I'm powerless over alcohol. If I do battle, I'm going to lose, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. And my life had become unmanageable. And that was as simple as the first step was for me. I had a lot of successes in my life. They were all fueled by alcohol. And I had a lot of failures in my life, and they were all fueled by alcohol. For me, I already told you the second step for me, the insanity for me is how I think. Not that I think, but how I think. My thinking is just a little skewed from the rest of the world. And for me, I'm a loner by nature. And Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. The hardest thing for me to do is come here and be with you. I'm a loner by nature. I like to sit on my couch by myself. I like to read. I like to fish. I like to be alone. I don't understand people who say when I'm by myself, I'm in bad company. I'm in my favorite company when I'm by myself. I entertain the hell out of myself. I do stand-up comedy for me. You know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. So this is just my experience. For me, the power greater than myself in step 2 was not God. Because being a loner If I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I'd have sat on my couch. God would have flown by, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. I would be on my couch watching Touched by an Angel right now. And somebody else would be here sharing their experience, strength, and hope with you. So for me, the power greater than myself was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You see, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have always tried to think my way into right living. That has never worked for me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you showed me that I could act my way into right thinking. Through taking the action and the steps, I have been restored to sanity. My thinking today is in line with the rest of the world. I'm an alcoholic. I'll always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while, I have a thought that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I clap. I say, thank you for your participation. I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. And I don't have to take an action on it. And I don't have to beat myself up for having that thought. And I don't have to run to you and tell you I'm a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's my alcoholism. And what being restored to sanity is for me is I don't have to take an action on my alcoholism. And I could never do that before. I could never not take an action on my alcoholism, because alcohol controlled my life. Step three for me, I hear people talking about having trouble with step three, and you know, you ask them what step they're on, they say, well, I'm on the third step. You know, every day I get up and I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but by about noon I take it back. Well, I'm on the third step, you know, I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And I hear those people, I pretty much stay away from them. I go the same way to work every day, and I drive up Chapman Avenue in Orange, and I get to an intersection, and I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right, so I make a decision to turn right, and I go straight to the intersection. So I make a U-turn, I'm going back toward the intersection, and I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn left, so I make a decision to turn left, and I go straight to the intersection. Dang, and I make a U-turn, I go back toward the intersection. I make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right. To make a decision, turn right, I go straight to the intersection. Now I'm getting irritated. Now I make another U-turn, I'm coming back toward the intersection. And I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn left. I take the steering wheel and I turn it. The book says it. It says, although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. The decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight, is really irrelevant. If I don't take an action, I'm going to go straight. And I'm going to make a U-turn and come back, and I'm going to make a U-turn and go back. And if I had never taken an action with the steering wheel, I'd still be going making U-turns up and down Chapman. So the decision in step three is this. How do you want to live? Chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, living in incomprehensible demoralization, a life of despair, no choices in your life, alcohol controls every area of your life, you're waking up with people you don't want to wake up with, you're doing things you don't want to do, or do you want to believe the people in AA are telling you the truth? Incomprehensible demoralization, despair, or hope? Despair, hope. It's not a difficult decision. I think I'll decide for hope. But unless I do something, the decision has no impact. The decision doesn't affect my life at all unless I do something. And for me, the something was the fourth step. The first action I had to take was the fourth step. I did the inventory the way you did. I made the columns. I wrote down everybody I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. What they did to me, well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. How it affected me, well, it affected my self-esteem, my self-worth, my pride, well, my security. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. But then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at what our part was. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore, but I did that. I did that column, and I looked at what my part was. And I did that with my fears, my resentments, and my relationships. And for the first time in my life, I saw who Patio was. So I spent my whole life putting on a show for you, and I'd come to believe the show. I didn't have a clue as to who I was. For the first time in my life, I saw who I was. I did my fifth step. It seems to me that I built a wall between me and you to keep you out, because it seems to me that people hurt me. As a small child, people let me down and they hurt me. And I'd made a decision I didn't want to be hurt anymore, so I built this big brick wall to keep you out. And the wall worked really well. It kept you out. You couldn't hurt me. What I never knew was that it made me a prisoner, and I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And when I did my fifth step, that wall didn't crumble. When I did my fifth step, one brick came out of that wall. And every time I've shared with another human being, another brick has come out of that wall. Till tonight, I have no brick wall between me and you. I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes because... Sometimes I get afraid. I mean, I hear people say, if you have faith, you can't have fear. I think that's poop. I have a tremendous amount of faith, but I'm a human being. You see, I thought if I worked the steps hard enough with enough zealousness, if I really worked the steps, I would kind of somehow soar above humanness. I would just kind of float up here above human and never have to experience a feeling that I judged as negative. The truth is, in working the steps, I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, I sometimes have fear. I have insecurity. I have moments of self-doubt. The difference tonight is when I have those feelings, I talk to one of you, I take your hand, and you walk with me through it. When I drink alcohol, I go to a bar, and I have another drink, and I have another drink, and I have another drink, and I have no choices. You walk with me through that. But as a human being, I have human feelings, and part of those feelings are fear, and sometimes you're not there. And when I have those feelings, I throw this little styrofoam wall up, and then one of you walks up in a big poof, and you knock it down and take my hand, and off we go. And you share with me one more time. You never told me what to do. You shared with me how you've done it, how you've stayed sober losing jobs, how you've stayed sober losing relationships, how you've stayed sober when there was a death in the family, how you've stayed sober living life on life's terms. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me an opportunity to live life on life's terms. And life's terms sometimes are painful. But you've shared with me how you've done it and not taken a drink. And that's why we come here. We come here to share how we've done it and not taken a drink, so that I can do it and not take a drink. Step 6 and 7 for me are the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell people don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what the miracle is. For me, the miracle is step 6 and 7. I went home from doing my fifth step, and I read in the book about step 6 and 7. I kind of got lulled into it, and when I became aware again of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey anything's ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. When I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading the seven-step prayer in the big book, and what it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I have been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be, and I believe that's the miracle. And I think too many people leave before they give themselves that chance. Too many people leave before they give themselves the opportunity to start to become the person God intended for them to be. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I hurt a lot of people for one more drink. When it came between this and one more drink, I took one more drink, no matter what this was. I gave up my career. I've given up families. I've given up relationships. Whatever it was, if it comes to this or one more drink, I take the drink. And the amends for me were more than saying sorry. Sorry, sorry, sorry. I've said that all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. The amends for me were learning to live my life differently. And I can't learn to live my life differently unless I come here and sit with you. Because you share with me how you live your life. And when you share with me how you live your life, I get an idea of how to live mine. And I go out there and I try to live my life the way you've shared that you live yours. And the amends were about living my life differently. Stopping doing the things that I was doing to hurt people. I always thought my family was dysfunctional. I discovered I was the dysfunction. My family's just fine. Through making amends with my family, you taught me how to be a daughter. You taught me how to be a sister. You taught me how to be an aunt. You taught me how to be a mother. And in making those amends, by living my life as if I was a good daughter, as if I was a good sister, as if I was a good mother, by taking that action day after day after day, week after week after week, month after month after month, year after year after year, I can tell you tonight that I am a wonderful daughter. I'm an excellent sister. I'm the best mother my son's ever had. You see, I'm by myself. I can't do that. I have to come here and let you share with me how to do it. And if I don't come here to listen to you share, I don't know how to do it. And I've made the amends that need to be made in my life. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? Step 11, my prayer in the morning is simple. It's very simply, thy will be done. I'm so naive that I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My prayer in the evening is a little scarier, and I offer it to any of you who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. When I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will keep me from getting irritated at the clerk at Lucky's because they're not moving fast enough. It will keep me from flipping somebody off on the freeway because they're not moving fast enough. When I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. Step 12 is the greatest gift that you've ever given me. The opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic. To look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you never have to live that way again a day at a time. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal, and I have gotten so much more. That old man that I thought was shooting heroin was sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason he nodded out in meetings is he had a peace and he had a rightness inside of him that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. And taking the action, the steps, and having the spiritual awakening in step 12, I can tell you tonight, as a result of the steps, I have a peace and I have a rightness inside. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal, and if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. I'm going to end with the story of a man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room and says, hell on the door, but when they open the door, it's a banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as he could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room, sitting amongst all that food, were starving. They were hungry. They were dying. And the reason they were starving is they had those long wooden spoons that people who cook with tied to their hands, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they were sitting amongst plenty, and they were dying. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was dying. Then he took him to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was the same scene, tables and tables and tables of food. As much food as he can ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those spoons tied to their hands, too. And they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But they were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And if I'm lucky, every once in a while, I get to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to another human being. And you don't have to have 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. If you have one day, you have something to give a person coming in. If you have one day, take that person's hand. Say, honey, come with me. Sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have to live this way anymore, a day at a time. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. And I want you to know that the spiritual malady that I have lived with all of my life, I don't live with anymore. Because of you, because of the 12 steps, and because of a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. And I end with this, and I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that we already heard read tonight. It's a line that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.